Welcome to Great Minds, and today, as we kick off season five, we are thrilled, literally over the moon thrilled, Susie, to welcome back Susie Essman, who was with us on one of the very first episodes we recorded almost 5 years ago. It's hard to believe.
It was actually 4 years ago. I remember the exact day. It was like February 26th or something, 2020, because it was right before lockdown.
It was that, and we did that one in person.
Yes, we did that one in person. And then right after I left you, I went to the Social Security office in Midtown Manhattan. I'm in the West 40 somewhere because somebody had hacked into my account and I had to go personally to fix it. And I think that's where I got COVID. And then I was sick for weeks after that. It was that day that we did the podcast.
A lifetime ago. In so many ways. So we're now in the midst and coming up to the end of the grand finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm, season 12. Yeah. It is an incredible journey. No one has ever seen anything like this. It's over almost 25 years?
24. We started in 2000.
Amazing.
Although, you know, I'm not sure if the pilot, which I was not in, if that was 1999 or 2000, but we shot episode one, season one in 2000.
And we're going to get into all that, but I thought we might start, Susie, in a different place. And one of the things we learned, you and I both getting a little bit older, and along that journey, we lose some people. And in the last couple of years, a few members of the Curb family we've lost. And I'd love to talk about, in either order, the late, great Richard Lewis, who we just lost recently, but we also lost Bob Einstein a few years ago. And I know he was a very dear member of the Curb family, very dear friend of yours.
Yeah. You know, Bobby, first of all, both of them were such completely original comedic voices. I mean, these are not people that could ever be replaced. And, you know, another, not part of the Curb family, but I was thinking about it. The day after you and I did this first podcast in 2020, the day after that, I went to Gilbert Gottfried's 65th birthday party. It was the next day. And he's also gone. And another completely original voice. And it's just heartbreaking because not only were they my dear friends, all three of them, but these are just some of the funniest people on stage, but in real life, the time that I spent with these people laughing uncontrollably. It's just heartbreaking when a person like that dies. It's heartbreaking when anybody dies that's close to you, but when it's somebody that is so original in their brain and their thought process and their thinking, it's just heartbreaking. Lewis just really, that one just hurts so bad.
Yeah, he had a tough time at the end, though, didn't he?
Yeah, well, you could see, watch season 12, even season 11, you see he's not well. And he had Parkinson's. He had been diagnosed with Parkinson's. He had had several surgeries, back surgery, shoulder surgery. Who knows what came first, or if they were separate or combined, or, you know, what. And he died, I don't know. I mean, now that it's a few weeks later and I'm over some of the initial shock of it, I'm feeling almost that there was a positive aspect to him dying of a heart attack just so quickly. And not a positive, I don't mean that. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
That he didn't have to continue to deteriorate. Because he had told me a couple of weeks, I spoke to him a couple of weeks before he died, and he was telling me how unhappy and frustrated he was that he had no creative outlet. He couldn't do stand-up anymore. He could barely sit and write anymore. He had no way to express himself, and that brain needed expression. So for a creative person to start to deteriorate like that, for anybody to start deteriorating like that, is a very hard thing to watch. I watch it with my brother. who has advanced stages of Parkinson's. So I almost felt a slight bit of relief that he left peacefully before he completely couldn't speak and walk. As it was, he was in a wheelchair. You know, we shot around him as much as we could. But you see, I mean, we're recording this, episode 9 aired last night. But you see in episode 8 last week, when he's in it with, I could see the brain, the comedic brain, was firing on all cylinders. It just was slow to come out. He couldn't get the words out.
I guess it's very much like my mom, who had dementia, but music stayed with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like for comedians, it may be the same thing, that the comedy stays with you.
Well, comedy is music. Comedy is all about rhythm and timing. That's why so many comedians are great musicians. It's the same kind of thing. And maybe, I don't know, I'm speculating, maybe it's a different part of the brain that doesn't get affected by the neurological damage that happens with these neurological diseases and dementia and things like that. That would be an interesting study.
That would be. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, years ago on your advice, I booked Richard for a private, and he was so good and really just, he was fantastic in so many ways, and what a long career. And of course, love to talk about that seminal night at Carnegie Hall as sort of the
1989.
Pinnacle.
I used to hear about it all the time. I sold at Carnegie Hall in 1989. If I had a dollar for every time he said that to me.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. He was also so out of his mind, Matt. I mean, in a lovable way. Nobody was sweeter than him and kinder and more loving and generous. Really generous with it as a friend. And he helped so many people in recovery too, because it's another thing that was part of his mantra is how many years he's been sober was part of his mantra. And I saw that Carnegie Hall and I did it, but he was incredibly generous in that way. And just, you know, I never did a scene where he didn't call me afterwards and tell me how great he thought I was, or, you know, he was just very kind in that way, but he was so neurotic and insane. I mean, we would do these gigs together. And 10 days before the gig, I would get an email and I'd be like, all right, fasten your seatbelts. Here we go. It's beginning. And then every day up until the gig, I would get, and I'm not exaggerating, 15, 20 emails from him a day, you know, up until we did the gig. And then day of the gig, long, like many, many long, long phone messages. I wouldn't even pick up because I couldn't bear to talk to him. Long, long phone messages. And that was all his anxiety and his neurosis over the gig. But he was insane, but in a good way.
Fantastic stuff. Anything when you lay awake at night and you think of them both separately, of course, any particular remembrances from a scene or something that happened, maybe that wasn't captured on camera, that you really just laugh about?
Well, Lewis, unfortunately, and Lewis and I always joked about this, that we didn't have scenes together. Every now and then we'd be at a dinner party together, usually at my house or something, but we never had any interaction with each other in all the 12 seasons. And we used to always say Larry saving him, us for him, you know, Larry saves the best for him. But we regretted that we never had that. And we were talking about it, you know, when we worked together in season 12, that this is it. And we still never had a scene together. Bobby and I had a whole bunch of scenes together. Einstein, he was another one. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Larry, he's such a great caster. You know, Lewis, of course, was his best friend in the whole world. Bob, not so much. I mean, they were friendly, but he just knew that Bob's voice would just add so much as Marty Funkhauser, which it did. And then, of course, when Bob died, that could not be replaced. He added Vince as Freddie Funkhauser, Vince Vaughn, who is tremendous, a brilliant improviser, and adds another layer, but doesn't replace Marty Funkhauser. You know, one does, you can't, it's not like the Darrens. You can't just like throw in Dick Sargent to replace Dick York.
Right.
On The Witch. It doesn't work that way, you know.
Right.
So Bobby, oh God, I so many funny scenes with him. He would just come up with stuff. I just remember once, maybe it was season 9, where he shows up late to the dinner we're having, and Larry asks him why he's late, and he was like, he got a colonoscopy, clean as a whistle. He just, I mean, there's so many things that he would just come up with. I remember once he kidnapped me. We were working. I was done. I didn't have a car. He said, I'll give you a ride home. But instead, he kidnapped me. And he just would not let me leave his side all day. And he took me to visit his grandson. And that was revelatory because he said his grandson was maybe, now he's an adult, but he was maybe 2 or 3 at the time. And we're sitting in this little apartment in Venice and the grandson's playing. And the look on Bob's face, just looking at his grandson, was just the most, I'd never seen him look like that. Just this quell joy. He had such joy just sitting, watching his grandson. Now that's fine, the kid was cute. But for me, after an hour, it's like, can we go? No, I was kidnapped. He wouldn't let me leave. Then he took me to Gladstone for lunch. He was crazy in that way. Every time you spent with him was an adventure because he was as Lewis was, as crazy off screen as he was on screen.
Oh, just priceless stuff. So let's go back to your earlier career and another seminal figure who we've also lost since we recorded that first episode, which was Rick Newman.
Yeah.
And Catch a Rising Star. And I know that club played a seminal role. I think it's where you met a lot of the folks who we've been talking about here.
Yeah.
But could we talk about Rick and Catch?
Well, it's where I met Larry. Most importantly, is where I met Larry. Catch a Rising Star. I started doing stand-up late 1983. I didn't really start till 1984. And Catch was the place in those days. Catch was the club you wanted to be in. That's where everybody in the industry went. I didn't pass there for a couple of years. It was very hard to get in at Catch. Although there seemed to be a lot of people who were not that great who were working, which used to drive me fucking crazy. But that was the club. And there were every single night in the mid-80s, there were lines on a Monday, lines around the block to get in. And every night when I was on stage there, I was for many years, I was the MC, I was the house MC, which at Catch was a very prestigious job. At other clubs, it was like a low level job. At Catch, when you were the MC, it was your show. You got to choose who came on and off. And it was like, this is my show and here are my friends. And that's where I really developed my sense of myself as a comedian. But every night you'd be on stage and you'd look in the audience and there would be Pete Townsend and there would be Warren Beatty and there would be David Bowie. And like every night there was a big star, a big rock star, a big movie star in the audience. And it was heady. I mean, it was like, it was a happening, fun place. And for me, it was home. It was my Cheers. I'd walk in, I'd know every bartender, every waitress, every comedian hanging out at the bar. And what we did in those days, because these were what was known as showcase clubs, which meant that we made no money. I think we got $7 on a weeknight called cab fare. And on the weekends, we'd get 50 for a spot. But it was a schmooze fest. It was where you like hung out with all your friends at the bar, the comedian friends. It's where you met everybody. And then there was always the person that was going to come in and bump you, like Robin Williams or somebody like that was going to come. You had a spot they were going to come in and bump you. And then you had to follow that. You had to follow Robin Williams, who just was on stage for 45 minutes being in, you know, that Robin Williams energy. And so it was a place where I really learned how to do stand-up, where I really learned who I was as a comedian. And Rick Newman, when I came in, he had already sold the club at that point. He took it back later. But Rick Newman was the founder of Catch a Rising Star. And he was also incredibly warm, supportive, loved comic. When I first met him, he was managing Belzer, who had been the house MC when he first started at Catch, which I then kind of took over, not took away from him. He was on to bigger and better things. And Belzer was also another one who died, who was a big influence and a very good friend. But Rick was, Rick created something. Rick knew how to create an atmosphere where he was the guy that would, you know, you hear about these people that when they're talking to you, they're only looking at you and that you feel like you're the only person in the room. And he was that guy. He knew how to make everybody feel special. Not a good businessman, picked up everybody's checks all the time, you know, not great in that aspect, but a great person for comedians because he loved comedians. He was always there to support you. And he knew how to create an atmosphere that was supportive, which I don't know that you could do it in the way that you could anymore. We were able to just, in those days, push the envelope, which allowed you to grow as a comic. And you were allowed to be bad, and that he still put you on. If you're not allowed to be outrageous and to be bad and to figure out as a young comic where the line is, I don't know how they do it anymore. You know, now that everybody has phones in the room and they're tweeting while they're in the room and they're videoing you surreptitiously and everything is so politically correct. I don't know how you're allowed to be really bad anymore, which is part of the growth process.
Yeah, it was also a place, as you said, where it was not only a nurturing environment, but a place where, you know, the A-list celebrities that you mentioned and many others could go and not be bothered. It was like a good space for them. And there were places like Tootsie Shores that had that same, that was the old Copacabana. I'm not so sure we have places like that anymore.
Yeah, I don't know, because I barely leave the house, Matt, as you know.
Oh, come on.
But look, we don't have the Friars Club anymore.
We don't.
You know, that was another place that you used to go and feel comfortable. And, you know, how many restaurants can you go where you could throw your bag on the chair and not even think about it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. They're probably, you know, we're elderly at this point. You're younger than me, but you're getting up there. There might be places younger people know that we don't know.
There might be.
But Catch was home. Catch was home. And Catch was where I developed, and Catch was where I learned, and Catch was where I met Larry.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I met Larry, I think it was 1985, something. And Larry was at that time a stand-up comic. I forgot what year he wrote for SNL, but he used to still come in. And that wasn't a good time for him anyway, the SNL years. He used to still come in to Catch all the time, and that's where I met him at the bar. And that's where he would tell me, Joy Behar and I would be hanging out at the bar, listening to all his tales of woe about his dating life, which then later on became all George Costanza storyline. And Jason Alexander, who played George Costanza, would say that he would read the script and he would say, well, this is not realistic, that we can't do this. This would never happen to anybody. And Larry would say, it happened to me. Things would happen to him that would happen to nobody else for some reason, still to this day. And that's where I first met him. And I remember once I was trying a new bit. I was doing this character who was the wife of an Elvis impersonator. You know, so she was that much removed from Elvis, of the wife of the, and Larry was in the room watching. And when I came off, he was gone. And somebody said to me, Larry really liked that bit. He thought you were really funny. And even back then, when he was nobody, this was pre-Seinfeld, even then you wanted Larry to approve of you, you know, because you saw that he had such a brilliant comedic mind, just like nobody else. You know, he would come up with premises and do bits like, you know, Jonas Salk's mother bragging about her son to the next door neighbor, or you know, what would happen if in the days of posses in the Old West you had an answering machine, you know, just premises that nobody else would come up with. And he didn't always have punchlines, and they were hilarious. So you always kind of wanted Larry's approval. And I remember it. I mean, I remember it from, you know, 40 years ago, somebody saying Larry thought you were funny, and like, wow, Larry David thought I was funny. You know, that was a big deal to me. Little did I know that I'd spend the rest of my life telling him to go fuck himself.
Years ago, through your good graces, we had Larry Charles on Great Minds, and we talked a lot about all the folks that come out of Brooklyn. And the same can be said of folks that come out of the Bronx.
Yeah.
You know, do you think there's something to this sort of New York breeding, that hard scrabble environment that we all came up in, that helps create so many great, funny, comedic minds?
Yeah, I do. I think, I mean, it's not a scientific survey, but I found that comedians who move, not all, clearly not Larry, but many comedians I know over the years moved to LA. Now, as you know, I never moved to LA. I always stayed in New York. That they lost an edge because they weren't constantly dealing with the elements like we deal with in New York. You know, you live in Manhattan, you live in Brooklyn, you live in the Bronx or Queens, Staten Island, I don't know from, but you can't escape the reality and the diversity of it. In LA, you live in a neighborhood and it's socioeconomically completely separate from other neighborhoods. And you're in your car and you're out of your car. You're not constantly on the street dealing with the stuff that we have to deal with. So I think what you're talking about is really a younger life. I think what you're talking about has more to do with being the children of immigrants. For so many of the earliest generation of comics, the George Burnses and Jack Bennies and Alan Kings and Milton Berle and all of those guys, I think that the immigrant sensibility, being the outsider looking in and having a sense of humor, lets you see things in a very different way than when you're part of the mainstream. Which is why it, generationally, then there was a lot of great Black comics, same thing.
Right.
And, you know, women, same thing. You're outside the power structure looking in. And as an outsider looking in, if you have a comedic brain, you see it in a skewed way that normal people, normal, I like that, using that word in that context, might not see it in that way.
And I think our crack great minds research team missed this our first go round a few years ago, but you're the great granddaughter of a great Russian opera impresario. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if it was a great Russian opera impresario. He ended up going bankrupt and broke. But yes, my great-grandfather, Leo Fyodorov, was the impresario of the Russian Grand Opera Company. And my grandmother was a ballet dancer in the company, which I have pictures of her, you know, was probably 40 pounds overweight, not like what you picture the ballerinas of our time. And my grandfather was the piano player for the opera company. That's how they met. My grandparents met. And they toured all, they left Russia in 1917, which was the revolution. They left Moscow and they toured all through the Far East for 5 years, Japan, Shanghai, Indonesia. I have all this Javanese jewelry from my grandmother that she got in Java. And then they came to the US through Portland. There's a great book. It's called Post Caviar. It's out of print. I have like, you know, a million copies of it, but it's about this crazy Russian opera company that came to Portland. Somebody had asked them to come to the United States to tour, but they didn't have a contract, and all of their costumes and sets were on the boat. The boat wouldn't release them until they were paid. And it was like this big scramble. And then they toured all through the country doing all these Boris Godunov and all these unknown Russian operas. They landed in New York, in Washington Heights, went bankrupt and stayed there. But then my great-grandfather, Leo Fyodorov, ended up doing Yiddish theater and silent movies. He was in Laugh, Clown, Laugh with Lon Chaney and Phantom of the Opera and a bunch of silent movies. I never met him. He died in 1948 or something. I never met him, but I do wear his watch chain, his watch fob.
What a great story. What a great
yeah,
story.
And it's a great story.
And I think you're right about the immigrant experience shaping so much. And I think so much of comedy, you know, I'm not a comedian. I will defer to you, but they say that
you're funny.
Well, I do my tender best, but that it comes from pain and from suffering. Yeah. And that's where a lot of the roots of comedy come from.
I also think it was not just being an immigrant. It was being a Jewish immigrant. And I think that was a even more of an outsider, because you were, you know, not a part of the mainstream religion in this country when they first came here, turn of the century, late 1800s, whatever it was. And I also think that part of it is for Jewish humor, I think part of it comes from the nature of the religion, because in Judaism, in order to be a learned person, you need to study Torah. Most, you know, Catholicism, until Gutenberg, nobody was allowed to read the Bible. They didn't want them reading the Bible. You just had to do what the priest told you. But for Jews, you had to study. And I think it created, and in reading the Torah, it was not just memorizing it, it was questioning it. It was all about questioning it. And I think in that questioning developed a certain kind of mindset of questioning the world around you. And what it means. And that's what comics do. Sometimes I think we see more and through a different prism of the comedic prism, and then we spit it out in a different way. And then people say, I never thought of it that way. And that's where the laughter is. You're spitting it out in a way that I never thought of, but it's familiar to me. Right. I recognize it, but I never thought of it in that particular twisted brain that the comedian has.
And certainly if there was a comedic Mount Rushmore in America, Larry would be on it. Someone else who would be on it is a name that we know and love. I'll say Melvin Kaminsky, who is, of course, Mel Brooks.
And Bronx boy. Oh, no, he was Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Carl was Bronx. Yeah.
Brooklyn. And I know it was one of your great joys was, I guess it was season 4, when you got to work with Mel.
Yeah. I didn't have any scenes with him, but I got to be on set when he was there, and I would show up a lot when he was there. You know, when I was, I mean, he was my idol as a kid. He was my first comedic voice in my head. And interestingly, that voice was improv. It was not what I saw. You know, we used to watch Ed Sullivan every Sunday night, and there was always a comic on it, great comics, you know, Jackie Mason and Joan Rivers and Alan King and, you know, all of them, Jackie Vernon and, you know, that whole group. And I thought they were funny, but I never looked at them and thought, oh, I want to do that. I didn't connect to that kind of a joke writing thing. It was never in my head, you know, that setup punch joke thing. But in 1960, when I was five and my parents got the 2000 Year Old Man album, I would bring that up to my room on my little record player and I would listen to it over and over. And we spoke before about the music. It was music to me. Something, and I couldn't have got, there's no way at 5 years old I'm getting all that stuff. There was sexual innuendos and things. I had no idea what they were talking about. But there was something in the rhythm of it that I knew was funny. And that was all improvised. That was a completely improvised concept. So that, and he did parts of the album that were not 2000-Year-Old Man. He played different characters. Dr. Hal Danish and the, you know, in the coffee house and all. If anybody has not heard that album, go out and listen to it. It still holds up and it's still brilliant.
I listened to it literally a few days ago again.
Because, oh, did you?
I do a playlist every year from the music. And this year I added the comedy of Great Minds from, and I just did the one from season four. And I had Journey Gunderson on, who is the director of the National Comedy Center up in Jamestown, right. This wonderful museum in this bizarrely remote location.
Jamestown, the birthplace of Lucille Ball.
Exactly. And they recently named the archives after Carl Reiner. And uh-huh. All of his, everything was donated by the Reiner family to the National Comedy Center. And you'll know this if I'm right or wrong, but legend has it that the 2000-Year-Old Man started off as a bit that Mel and Carl would do for their friends.
Could be wrong about this, but I think it started when they were both writers for Sid Caesar for Your Show of Shows. And I think it started there in the writer's room that Carl would just ask Mel a question and Mel would go off as this character. And then they brought it to parties and they would do it. And then somebody, you know, told them to record it and they did. And I'm sure it was a structured improv. They kind of had an idea of which bits they were going to do. But it was improv. And somehow I connected to that. That was the thing that I connected to. That and the Carol Burnett Show, which was also sketchy. Mm. And the thing that I loved the most about the Carol Burnett Show, as opposed to other shows, was that they would crack up. You know, Harvey Korman was, and Tim Conn, they were always laughing and they always seemed like they had so much fun. And then I got to recreate that on Curb, because we laugh all day long on Curb. I mean, all day long, we're laughing.
Let's talk about the show a little bit now. I think it's a great lead-in. You, and one of the podcasts that I listen to now religiously, The History of Curb, that you're doing with Jeff, you talk about the one piece of direction that Larry gave you, and only one, which I thought was so amazing that in all those years, literally the creation of Susie Green is all you, but he gave you one piece of direction. Can you share that?
Yes. However, it was not all me in the sense that he would write things that I would create the character around. You know what I mean? In the outlines. It was season one. It was the episode called The Wire. It was when Jeff brings a Fresh Air Fund kid in to live in our house and the kid robs us blind. And that was the scene he had in mind when he hired me. I was in a few other scenes, but I was kind of innocuous in the other scenes. And the only thing he said to me is, I want you to rip Jeff a new asshole. It was the only direction he gave to me. And that was it. Then I went from there. The other thing that he did in that scene was, I'm yelling, I'm screaming, and kept on saying, go further, be dirtier, curse more, you know. And I wasn't, and finally he pulled me over and he said, make fun of Jeff's back. I was like, Larry, I don't want to do that. You've seen my stand-up that I don't do anymore, Matt. I'm not one to go after what somebody looks like. To me, that was always low, to pick on what somebody looks like. But he egged me on to it. He was like, just do it. Like, it's not nice. He's got an eating disorder. I don't want to hurt his feelings. He knows you're just acting. Just do it. So I did, and that let the genie out of the bottle. That was it when I called him a fat fuck for the first time. Now, just for clarity, over the years, he has given me other direction, but it's basically only been more, less. Like, be bigger, be less. That's the only kind of direction he's ever given me. And that's actually been rare as well.
And you referred to it, but you all break each other up, much like Tim Conway and Harvey Korman and Carol Burnett and Vicki Lawrence way back when.
Yeah. I tend not to break as much because I'm in character. Larry's the worst. Larry breaks all the time. But you know, he's having such a good time. He's having so much fun. So I always really never minded that he's like laughing so much, because that just means he's going to do more seasons because he's having such a great time. He loves it.
And in that first season, you know, I remember you had Diane Keaton, but voice only. She did not appear on camera. It was not a hot thing for others, you know, celebrities to make cameos. No. Now, I mean, there's nobody you haven't had, pretty much, including Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen. Or I run into people, famous actors, and they beg me to get them on the show. Beg me. And some of them have been on and some have not. But you know what Larry does is he writes these things and just assumes that people, okay, Bruce Springsteen, okay, so if it wasn't Bruce, it could have been Paul McCartney. I mean, he could have found somebody, or Paul Simon, or whatever. He could have found some big rock star to do it. But he's written specific things for very specific people, not knowing whether or not they're going to say yes to it. For example, in season 9, the Fatwa episode, he wrote this whole thing with Lin-Manuel Miranda as a key figure in it, not knowing if Lin-Manuel Miranda was going to say yes to it or was even available. And he's done that several times, but they always say yes.
Who would say no?
Well, sometimes people are busy, you know.
Right. And you talked about it in the podcast, but it was, you know, sort of midway through season 1 when you felt you really hit your stride. Talk about that moment when things really started to click and come together, when the show, as you said, started to find its voice.
You know, if I look back, well, that scene for Susie in The Wire was the first real Susie Green scene, which then I didn't do a scene like that again till season 2 with the doll, which I think really cemented the character, and not just the character, the relationship between the three of us, Larry, Jeff, and I, and that they lived in fear of Susie, and that Susie, you know, was dominant in that way. So that didn't really happen until season 2. But, you know, I remember, I've said this before, I'll say it again. We don't have a script. We have an outline. As you know, it's about 7 to 20. They've gotten longer and longer as the seasons have gone on, because they've gotten denser and more complex. But there's an outline, and it tells you what has to happen in each scene, but there's no dialogue written. So the first outline I read from season 1 was Beloved Aunt. And I remember, which is a brilliant episode. I mean, just, it's so, if you read that outline, I remember reading that outline and thinking, okay, this is something really special. Because before I read that outline, I showed up for a scene here, a scene there. I didn't know what the show was. He wasn't giving people the outlines to read, and I just didn't know what it was going to be. We seemed to be doing some funny stuff, but you just never know. But once I read that outline, I knew that this was something that was transcendent in a way. And if you look at that episode, it's a classic, and every season we have one or two classics. It is a perfectly crafted half hour of comedy, as is The Doll in season 2. Perfectly crafted half hour of comedy. And anybody who wants to learn how to write a half hour of comedy should look at those shows.
At what point did you and, you know, the rest of the cast really know, and the core cast I'm talking about between you and Jeff and Cheryl, of course, Larry, really know that you had something here, that this thing was going to really go for a while?
Well, every season Larry would say, that's it, I'm done, I'm not doing another, you know, fine. I didn't have a contract for years. I was a day player, getting day scale, you know. Anecdotally, it wasn't until after season three aired that people started stopping me on the street. We were really under the radar, and thank God we were with HBO. If we had been with a network, they would have canceled us already. But HBO was incredibly supportive. We were really, really low budget at that time. And that was, that was like pre-golden age of television, but it was golden age of HBO because that was, The Sopranos. I mean, the HBO really has to be credited with changing television, I think, from our show, Sex and the City, Sopranos, there's so many, Deadwood, 6 Feet Under. I mean, all of those great HBO shows. I'm missing some, but just that was really when television really started to change in a way that we see now with, Mad Men was even the past, but was after that, and, on and on and on. But HBO deserves a lot of credit for sticking with us because we were just this little, we were their little experiment, their little comedy experiment. And they stuck with it because they believed in how funny it was. And it was. I've gone back and watched those episodes. Some of them don't work as well as others, but by and large, it's all, working. And they really just stuck with us and supported and never gave Larry any kind of restrictions or constrictions or notes or anything. Like, I don't think they've ever given him help.
Which he loved to make fun of in subsequent seasons.
Yeah. What the audience might not realize, when you're doing a network show, you do a run, first you do a read through. First day you do a read through. And the network execs are there. And these are not comedians or comedy writers or people who are necessarily funny. But in order to justify their positions, they give you notes. And every now and then you get some good notes, but by and large, they're horrible. And then they come to the run through, and then they come to the dress rehearsal, and then they get, and it's like notes, notes, notes. And it drives you crazy. And it's like they take the comedy away, for half the time. Larry has said that all the years that he did Seinfeld, he never listened to any of the notes. Now, I don't know. Larry's magical in some way because any other showrunner would have been fired if they didn't listen to the notes. Maybe the fact that the numbers were so high, but they weren't in the beginning, so I don't know what it was. I mean, it ended up being the most successful show in the history of television, Seinfeld, but it didn't start out that way. And somehow they let Larry do it. And I don't know how he got the job in the first place because they have a list of showrunners of who you could use. Larry wasn't on that list. You have to have been successful already to be on list or having been a writer on another show, not SNL, but another sitcom. They've been on that list. Somehow he snuck through and created what he created, which is amazing. And another thing I'll say about Larry is I think, and I mean, he's one of my closest friends and I love him more than anything, but it's also to have created Seinfeld, he co-created with Jerry. But, from what I've heard from so many people I know who wrote on the show, he rewrote almost every single script on that show. He'd have writers, they'd write it, their names would be on the credits. But he rewrote almost every script in that Larry voice. And when you see Curb, you see how much of Seinfeld was Larry's voice. You see the commonality. To have done Curb Your Enthusiasm after the success of Seinfeld and to have two iconic, really, shows like that, I think is highly unusual. Most
No.
people don't have a second act like that.
No. It's that's like Rocky Marciano, and retiring
Yeah.
undefeated. Talk about you talked about the sort of the evolution or that very beginning seminal moment going back, and then the doll. I agree with you, really cemented, the character of Susie Greene in pop culture. But you've become a pop culture icon. And your fashion, your
Yeah.
everything, you're quoted, you're now a reference that people make comedically in other contexts, your
And Matt,
expressions.
you and I have been friends for when did we meet?
It's about 20, it's
2005?
getting
Four?
almost 20 years. You opened for us for Jon Stewart at Jazz at Lincoln Center
Who I saw Jon Stewart
through
the other day.
our old pal Eddie Micon.
Eddie Micon, who brought us together. He's a
Yeah.
bringer of people together,
He
Rome.
is. He is
Eddie is. We
indeed.
love him. So you've watched that for with me over all these years, how it's developed and changed. And what can I tell you? I feel incredibly grateful and lucky to have been on this show. And to, you know, to look, as a comic, we're all out there struggling and doing stand up and you know, if you get offered a part on a series, you'll take it because that's where the real money is. And once you're on television, then you could command more money for your personal appearances. You know, it's a whole process. But I could have been cast on some crappy, you know, CBS or NBC sitcom that limped along for, sometimes you see these sitcoms, you never even saw them or heard of them. They've been on for 7 or 8 years and you're making a shit ton of money. And I could have ended up on one of those. And I would have been grateful for it because I would have made a living and I could have supported myself and my family and I would have made more money on the whatever. But to have been on this show, to have been on Curb Your Enthusiasm for 12 seasons, I'm the luckiest girl in America.
Fantastic stuff. And your career path, I mean, you're far from, you know, just this one trick. You've been on so many other shows, Broad City and animated films, Balt. I know you're always got something cooking. Is there something that you want to do that you haven't done? Is there another goal ahead, or is it just let's just see what happens next?
It's just let's just see. I don't have another goal ahead. I had the goal is to work with real. I'm very spoiled to work with really great people and do funny stuff. I mean, as you know, I don't want to do stand up anymore. I put that to rest, that part of my life, which was a great part of my life and a pivotal part of my life. But I want to still do acting. I want to still do things that are fun and interesting and creative. I'll never have a job like this again. This is the highlight of my life. And I'm okay with that because it lasted for so long and it's out there for all the world to see. And I'll probably never work with a genius like Larry again, because he's one of a kind. I've never met anybody else at that level. But there's still a lot of great people out there. There's still a lot of funny people out there. And there's still a lot. I have a couple of things I can't talk about. But a couple of irons in the fire. One is an animated project and another is something that might be happening, a limited series that might be happening with some really interesting younger people, creative people, and creating with their voice. What I will miss the most about Curb, and I might have this again, I don't know, but what I'll miss the most about Curb is being, because it's improvised and because there's no script, being such an important part of the creative process. So Larry comes up and Jeff Schaefer, we can't forget Jeff Schaefer, who's just the greatest. And, you know, he's our fearless leader and the mad genius behind the whole show. He writes all the outlines with Larry and he directs almost every episode and edits all of them with Larry. But they come up with all the ideas, but everything that comes out of my mouth, I make up. So I don't know that I'll ever have that kind of experience again. It's just the most joyous thing I could ever do. That doesn't mean I can't have other great creative experiences. So that's, right. I don't have anything. There's not something that I think, I don't have a bucket list of what I still want to do, right, except get a hole in one.
Oh, God. Somebody asked me recently, do you think you'll ever get a hole in one? And as you know, I am very optimistic and positive. And I, without missing a beat, I said, no. I just don't think that will happen.
Well, how about that? My husband, who is your frequent golf partner, got 2 last year.
We got to get Jimmy back out there. We got to get him off the injured reserve list and get him back out there.
He'll be back soon. So no, I mean, people ask me all the time, do you want to do Broadway? You know, the things like that. Not really.
Right. Right.
Not really.
Right. And, you know, as you reflect on it, are you surprised the way the whole thing went down? You talked about HBO support early. I think today, the streaming world that we've watched, you know, Susie Green's voice and persona, you know, catch fire across America and become an indelible part of popular culture. We've also watched the industry change tremendously in that 24 some odd years. You know, you have to wonder, would that show get made today? And the streaming ecosystem, the business is really upside down in so many ways.
Yeah, I think we're in a place where we don't know what's going to happen post strikes. I thought post strike that there was going to be a huge boom in production. There hasn't been. Things have been very slow to come back. Part of that is because there's other strikes looming. I think IATSE might go on strike, and the Teamsters might go on strike. I'm not sure. But also, you know, when all this streaming stuff started happening and they were throwing so much money at these productions, I thought this is not sustainable. These are subscriptions. How are they going to sustain all this money they're throwing at these series? And I was right. And it's something's going to, I don't know, maybe we're going to go back to basic cable. I don't know what we're going to go back to. But entertainment's not going to end.
Yeah.
You know, it's something, it's always evolving. It's always changing. You know, like how our parents used to say, it's not like the old days. I don't care about that. I feel like there's more good stuff coming up in the future, and it has to constantly evolve.
Yeah, and you are always so good to everybody on set, you know, including my son Benny, when you enabled him to be a PA a couple years ago. I did read somewhere that, you know, the number of jobs there and activity out of places that you don't think of, like the prop houses and things like that, is way down.
It's way down for below the line. It's called, yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. When we were on strike, you know, this is a huge business. It employs a huge number of people. And there's all these ancillary businesses that are attached. The catering, the dry cleaning, the, you know, whatever it may be, the locations, you know, all of this stuff. So there's an adjustment now. There's just not as much production right now. That doesn't mean that a year from now, it's not going to be booming again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we are in the midst of a reset, and we'll see where it all settles.
Yeah.
All
it'll right, be interesting to see. What do you think is going to happen?
I think that what you said is right. I think everybody went running into the streaming business, throwing not just millions, but billions of dollars out there.
Yeah.
And you're now seeing Paramount is up for sale. You're seeing, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery really struggle to find their footing. You know, they just took on so much debt. And, you know, I'm a big fan of David Zaslav and his team.
Good friend. Yeah.
But I think when you have that much debt, you know, it creates a lot of pressure. Netflix,
right.
Netflix is different in that
they came out on top right now.
And they got their international distribution right early. You know, anywhere I go in the world, whether it's in Johannesburg or in October, I was in Riyadh, you know, and I can pull up Netflix and watch Seinfeld. You know,
even when
I go to London now, I wanted to watch and catch up. I had missed an episode, and Max doesn't work yet in the UK.
Oh,
so,
really? Interesting.
So I think that's part of it also, is that, you know, they've got that global subscription base that nobody else really has.
And of course,
we'll
Amazon and Apple have other sources of revenue, sources of revenue.
Yeah, it's an ancillary it's an ancillary business for them. You know, when they do their quarterly reports, they don't even mention it. You know, it's not a big part of their business. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. But I think we're not near the end yet. I think there's a lot more to go.
And I also think, Matt, that everybody's still going to want comedy.
Yeah.
Who's not going to want comedy?
Oh, exactly.
Why we have to make sure we do not have a totalitarianism in this country, because the first thing to go in a totalitarian regime is comedy, because comedy is by its nature subversive and questions the status quo. And there's certain types of people that don't want their quo questioned.
Yeah, no, that is certainly true. And I think the late night host certainly and people like Jon Stewart are having a field day, and deservedly so, on our former president. So as we wrap, Susie, I'd be remiss not to ask, it's such a seminal moment. It's an emotional moment. I'm sure the wrap party was a special moment for season 12 of Curb. As you reflect, you know, what do you think about over these years? I mean, clearly very grateful and feel fortunate. And I don't think it's pessimistic at all to say that I've done the best thing I'm ever going to do and work with the best people I'm ever going to work with as a still relatively young person. But You know, what comes to mind for you when you reflect on 24 years of Curb?
It's definitely over. When after season eight, I remember Larry calling me and saying, "We're done." And we were done for 6 years. And I remember going into a deep, deep depression because I wasn't done. I wasn't finished with her. I wasn't done with Susie Green. This time, before we started shooting, which was already almost 2 years ago, when he called me and told me this is going to be the final season, it felt right to me. It's still, this season is so brilliantly funny. It has not jumped the shark by any means. And I feel like let's, he's 76. I'm going to be 69 in 2 months. You know, it's time for this particular aspect of this particular show to be over. And it feels, it's bittersweet. I feel tremendous longing and sadness for doing it again, but it feels correct right now for this period of time. So it's, there's no regrets at all that it's over. I don't regret that it's over. It feels right. And I feel, you know, I feel a part of history, a part of television history. And that will never go away. That's part of my legacy for my entire life. But, you know, Richard dying so recently, and as you know, my sister died last year. And I think about, okay, I'm pushing 70. Things happen. How would I feel if I knew I was going to die tomorrow? I would feel that I made a lot of people laugh.
You sure did. Well, Susie, I can't thank you enough. You have made a lot of people laugh. You're a joy in our lives. Isla and I are so grateful for your friendship and Jimmy's. And can't wait to see you soon and get you out to the new house. And
Yeah.
we'll get back to Rockland soon and get on the golf course with Jimmy when he's healed. And I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Love you, Maddie.